One of the first things I think young people, especially nowadays, should learn how to do is see for yourself and listen for yourself and think for yourself, and then you can come to an intelligent decision for yourself. But if you form the habit of going by what you hear others say about someone, or going by what others think about someone, instead of going and searching that thing out for yourself and seeing for yourself, you will be walking west when you think you're going east. You'll be walking east when you think you're going west. So this generation, especially of our people, have a burden upon themselves more so than at any other time in history. The most important thing we can learn how to do today is think for ourselves. It's good to keep wide open ears and listen to what everybody else has to say. But when you come to make a decision, you have to weigh all of what you heard of its own and place it where it belongs. And then come to a decision for yourself, and you'll never regret it. But if you form the habit of taking what someone else says about a thing without checking it out for yourself, you'll find that other people will have you hating your own friends and loving their enemies. And this is one of the things that our people are beginning to learn today, that it's very important to think out a situation for yourself. If you don't do it, then you'll always be maneuvered into actually, you'll never fight your enemy, but you will find yourself fighting your own self. And I think our people in this country are the best examples of that, because many of us want to be nonviolent. I myself would go for nonviolence if it was consistent, if it was intelligent. If everybody was going to be nonviolent, and if we were going to be nonviolent all the time, I'd say, okay, let's get with it. We'll all be nonviolent. But I don't go along, and I'm just telling you how I think, I don't go along with any kind of nonviolence unless everybody's going to be nonviolent. If they make the Ku Klux Klan nonviolent, I'll be nonviolent. If they make the White Citizens Council nonviolent, I'll be nonviolent. But as long as you got somebody else not being nonviolent, I don't want anybody to come to me talk any kind of nonviolent talk. And I don't think that it is fair to tell our people to be nonviolent unless someone is out there making the Klan and the Citizens Council and these other groups also be nonviolent. Now, I'm not criticizing those here who are nonviolent. I think everybody should do it the way they feel is best. And I congratulate anybody who can be nonviolent in the face of all that kind of action that I read about in that part of the world. But I don't think that you will find the upcoming generation of our people, especially those who have been doing some thinking, who will go along with any form of nonviolence unless nonviolence is going to be practiced all the way around. If the leaders of the nonviolent movement can go into the white community and teach nonviolence, good. I go along with that. But as long as I see them teaching nonviolence only in the black community, then we can't go along with that. We believe in equality. And equality means you have to put the same thing over here that you put over here. And if just black people alone are going to be the ones who are nonviolent, then it's not fair. We throw ourselves off guard. And in fact, we disarm ourselves and make ourselves defensive. The Organization of Afro-American Unity is a non-religious group of black people in this country who believe that the problems confronting our people in this country need to be reanalyzed and a new approach devised towards trying to get a solution. And studying the problem, we recall that prior to 1939 in this country, all of our people in the north, south, east, and west, no matter how much education we had, were segregated. We were segregated in the north just as much as we were segregated in the south. And even right now, today, there's as much segregation in the north as there is in the south. There's some worse segregation right here in New York City than there is in Macomb, Mississippi. But up here, they're subtle and tricky and deceitful. And they make you think that you got it made when you haven't even begun to make it yet. So realize that prior to 1939, that our people were in a very menial position or condition, and both of us were waiters and porters and bellhops and janitors and waitresses and things of that sort. And it was not until war was declared in Germany by Hitler and America became involved in a manpower shortage, plus she became involved in a manpower, she was faced with a manpower shortage in regards to her factories plus her army. And it was only then that the black man in this country step forward when he himself headed back to the wall. In Michigan, where I was growing up at that time, I recall that the best jobs in the city for blacks were waiters out at the country club. And in those days, if you had a job waiting table in the country club, you had it made. Or if you had a job at the state house, having a job at the state house didn't mean that you were a clerk or something of that sort. You had the shoe shine stand in the state house. And just by being in there, where you could be around all these big politicians, that made you a big shot Negro. You were shining shoes, but you were a big shot Negro because you were around big shot white people, and you could bend their ear and get up next to them. And you, oftentimes in those days, were chosen to be the voice of the Negro community. Now, and also right at that time, 1939, 40, 41, they weren't drafting Negroes in the Army nor the Navy. Negro couldn't join the Navy in 1940 or 41 in this country. He couldn't join. They wouldn't take a black man in the Navy. They would take him if they wanted him and make him a cook, but he couldn't just go and join the Navy. And he couldn't just go, I don't think he could just go and join the Army. Now, they weren't drafting him when the war first started. And this is what they thought of you and me in those days. For one thing, they didn't trust us. And they feared that if they put us in the Army and trained us on how to use rifles and other things, that we might shoot at some target that they had to pick up. So, and we would have. Any thinking man knows what target to shoot at. And a man doesn't. He has to have someone else to choose his target, and he's not thinking for himself. They're doing the thinking for him. So, it was only when the when the Negro leaders, the same type of Negro leader, Hank DeFay, Negro leaders in those days that we have today, when the Negro leaders saw all the white fellows being drafted and taken into the Army and dying on the battlefield, and no Negroes were dying, so they weren't being drafted. The Negro leaders come up and said, we got to die too. We want to be drafted too, and we demand that you take us in there and let us die for our country. This is what the Negro leaders said back in 1940. I remember A. Philip Randolph was one of the leading Negroes in those days. Who said it? He's one of the big six right now. So, and this is why he's one of the big six right now. So, when they started drafting Negro soldiers then, and then they started letting Negroes get into the Navy. But not until Hitler and Tojo and the foreign powers were strong enough to bring pressure upon this country so that it headed back to the wall and it needed us. And at that same time, they let us work in factories. Up until that time, we couldn't work in the factories. I'm talking about the North as well as the South. And when they let us work in the factories, we began, at first, when they let us in, we could only be janitors. Then after a year or so passed by, they let us work on machines. We became machinists. Got a little skill. And as we got a little more skill, we made a little more money, which enabled us to live in a little better neighborhood. When we lived in a little better neighborhood, we went to a little better school, got a little better education, and could come out and get a little better job. So the cycle was broken somewhat. But the cycle was not broken because of some kind of sense of moral responsibility on the part of the government. No. The only time that cycle was broken even to a degree was when world pressure was brought to bear upon the United States government and they were forced to look at the Negro, and then they didn't even look at us as human beings. They just put us into their system and let us advance a little bit farther because it served their interests. But they never let us advance a little bit farther because they were interested in our interests or interested in us as human beings. Any of you who have a knowledge of history, sociology, political science, all the economic development of the country, and its race relations, all you have to do is take what I'm telling you and go back and do some research on it, and you'll have to admit that this is true. It was during the time that Hitler and Tojo, the Japanese emperor, were able to make war with this country and put pressure upon them, Negroes in this country then advanced a little bit. At the end of the war with Germany and Japan, then Joe Stalin was a threat. Joe Stalin and Communist Russia were a threat. And during that period, we made a little bit more advance. Now, the point that I'm making is this. Never at any time in the history of our people in this country have we made advances or advancement or made progress in any way just based upon the internal goodwill of this country or based upon the internal activity of this country. We have only made advancement in this country when this country was under pressure from forces above and beyond its control. Because the internal sense of, the internal moral consciousness of this country is bankrupt. It hasn't existed since they first brought us over here and made slaves out of us. They trick up on the conversation and make it appear that they have our good interests at heart, but when you study it every time, no matter how many steps they take us forward, it's like we're standing on a, what you call that thing, a treadmill. That is, the treadmill is moving backwards faster than we're able to go forward in this direction. We're not even standing still. We're walking forward at the same time going backwards. So I say that because the Organization of Afro-American Unity, in studying the process of this so-called progress during the past 20 years, we realize that the only time the black man in this country is given any kind of recognition or shown any kind of favor at all, or even his voice is listened to, is when America is afraid of outside pressure, or when she's afraid of her image abroad. And so we could see that as long as we sat around and carried on our struggle at a level or in a manner that involved only the goodwill of the internal forces of this country, we would continue to go backwards if we no real meaningful change is made. So, the Organization of Afro-American Unity saw that it was necessary to expand the problem and the struggle of the black man in this country until it went above and beyond the jurisdiction of the United States. For the past 15 years, the struggle of the black man in this country was labeled as a civil rights struggle. And as such, it remains completely within the jurisdiction of the United States. You and I could get no kind of benefit whatsoever other than that which would be forthcoming from Washington, D.C., which meant, in order for it to be forthcoming from Washington, D.C., all of the congressmen and the senators would have to agree to it. But the congressmen, the most powerful congressmen and the most powerful senators were from the South. They were from the South because they had seniority in Washington, D.C., and they had seniority because our people in the South, where they came from, couldn't vote. They just didn't have the right to vote. So, once we saw that we were up against a hopeless battle internally, we saw the necessity of getting allies at the world level, or from abroad, or from all over the world. And so immediately we realized that as long as the struggle was a civil rights struggle was under the jurisdiction of the United States, we would have no real allies or real support. We decided that the only way to make the problem rise to the level where we could get world support was to take it out of the civil rights label, or take it away from the civil rights label and put it in the human rights label. That the struggle of the black man in this country for the past 10 or 15 years has been called the struggle for civil rights. So as long as you're struggling for civil rights, what you're doing is asking these racist segregationists who control Washington, D.C., and they control Washington, D.C. They control the federal government through these committees. And as long as this thing is a civil rights struggle, you're asking it at a level where your so-called benefactor is actually someone from the worst part of this country. And you can only go forward to the degree that they let you. But when you get involved in a struggle for human rights, it's completely out of the jurisdiction of the United States government. You take it to the United Nations. And then when you have any problem that is taken to the United Nations, the United States has no say-so on it whatsoever, because in the UN she only has one vote. And in the UN, the largest block of votes is the African continent of Africa, has the largest block of votes than any continent on this earth. And the continent of Africa, coupled with the Asian bloc and the Arab bloc, comprises the over two-thirds of the UN forces, and they're the dark nations. That's the only court that you can go to today and get your own people who look like you on your side, to be the United Nations. And this could have been done 15 years ago. It could have been done 19 years ago. But they tricked us. They got a hold of our leaders and used our leaders to lead us right back to their courts, knowing that they control their courts. And so the leaders look like they're leading us against an enemy, but when you analyze the struggle that we've been involved in for the past 15 years, the good or the progress that we've made is actually disgraceful, and we should be ashamed to even use the word progress in the context of our struggle. So, there has been a move on, and I will conclude. there has been a move on to keep the Negro thinking in this country that he was making strides in the civil rights field, only for the purpose of distracting him and not letting him know that were he to acquaint himself with the structure of the United Nations and the politics of the United Nations, the aim and the purpose of the United Nations, he could lift his problem into that world body, and he'd have the strongest stick in the world that he could use against the racists in Mississippi. But it was known that one of the arguments against getting you and me to do this has always been that our problem is a domestic problem of the United States. And as such, we should not think to put it at a level where somebody else can come and mess with United States domestic affairs. But you're giving Uncle Sam a break. Uncle Sam's got his hands in the Congo, in Cuba, in South America, in Saigon. Uncle Sam has got his bloody hands in every continent and in everybody else's business on this earth. But at the same time, when it comes to taking forceful action in this country, where our rights are concerned, he's always going to tell you and me, well, these are states' rights. Or he'll make some kind of off-the-wall alibi that's not a bona fide alibi, not because it's an alibi, but to justify his inactivity where you and my rights are concerned. So we were successful, have been successful, in first when we realized that we had to bring this to the United Nations, we knew that we had to get support, we had to get world support, and that the most logical part of the world to look for support is among people who look just like you and me. And so I was fortunate to be able to make a tour of the African continent during the summer. I went to first in the Middle East and Africa. I went to first to Egypt, then to Arabia, Kuwait, Lebanon, and then to Sudan, Ethiopia, Kenya, Tanganyika, Zanzibar, Nigeria, Ghana, Guinea, Liberia, and Algeria. And I found, while I was traveling on the African continent, I had already detected it in May, that someone had very shrewdly planted the seed of division on this continent to make the Africans not show genuine concern with our problems, just as they plant seeds in your and my mind so that we won't show concern with the African problem. They're trying to make you and me think that we're separate and the two problems are separate. So that when I went back this time and traveled to those different countries, I was fortunate enough to spend an hour and a half with Nasser in Egypt, which is a North African country, and 3 hours with President Nyerere in Tanganyika, which has now become Tanzania, which is an East African country, and with Prime Minister Obote, Milton Obote in Uganda, which is also an East African country, and with Jomo Kenyatta in Kenya, which is another East African country, and with President Azikiwe in Nigeria, President Nkrumah in Ghana, and President Sucre in Guinea. And I found that in every one of these African countries, the head of state is genuinely concerned with the problem of the black man in this country. But many of them thought that if they opened their mouth and voiced concern, that they would be insulted by the American Negro leaders. Because one head of state in Asia voiced his support of the civil rights struggle, and couple of the big six had the audacity to stab his face and say they weren't interested in that kind of help, which in my opinion is asinine. And so that the African leaders only had to be convinced that if they took an open stand at the governmental level and showed interest in the problem of black people in this country, that they wouldn't be rebuffed. And today, you'll find in the United Nations, and it's not an accident, that every time the Congo question or anything on the African continent is being debated in the Security Council, they couple it with what's going on or what's happening to you and me in Mississippi and Alabama and these other places. And in my opinion, the greatest accomplishment that was made for the struggle of the black man in America in 1964 towards some kind of real progress was the successful linking together of our problem with the African problem, or making our problem a world problem. Because now, whenever anything happens to you in Mississippi, it's not a case of just somebody in Alabama getting indignant or somebody in New York getting indignant. Whatever happens in Mississippi today with the attention of the African nations drawn toward Mississippi at a governmental level, then the same repercussions that you see all over the world when an imperialist or foreign power interferes in some section of Africa, you see repercussions. You see the embassies being bombed and burned and overturned. Nowadays, when something happens to black people in Mississippi, you will see the same repercussions all over the world. And I wanted to point this out to you because it is important for you to know that when you're in Mississippi, you're not alone. But as long as you think you're alone, then you take a stand as if you're a minority or as if you're outnumbered, and that kind of stand will never enable you to win a battle. You've got to know that you've got as much power on your side as that Ku Klux Klan has on its side. And when you know that you've got just as much power on your side as the Klan has on its side, you'll talk the same kind of language with that Klan is talking with you. I say one more thing and then I conclude. When I say the same kind of language, I should explain what I mean. See, you can never have good relations with anybody that you can't communicate with. You can never have good relations with anybody that doesn't understand. There has to be an understanding. Understanding is brought about through dialogue. Dialogue is communication of ideas. This can only be done in a language, a common language. And you can never talk French to somebody who speaks only German and think you're communicating. Neither, they don't get the point. And you have to be able to speak a man's language in order to make him get the point. Now, you've lived in Mississippi long enough to know what the language of the Ku Klux Klan is. They only know one language. And now you can come up with another language. You don't communicate. You've got to be able to speak the same language they speak, whether you were in Mississippi, New York City, or Alabama, or California, or anywhere else. And when you develop or mature to the point where you can speak another man's language on his level, that man gets the point. That's the only time he gets the point. You can't talk peace to a person who doesn't know what peace means. You can't talk love to a person who doesn't know what love means. And you can't talk any form of nonviolence to a person who doesn't believe in nonviolence while you're wasting your time. So I think in 1965, whether you like it or I like it or we like it or they like it or not, you will see that there is a generation of black people born in this country who become mature to the point where they feel that they have no more business being asked to take a peaceful approach than anybody else takes, unless everybody's going to take a peaceful approach. So we, here in the Organization of Afro-American Unity, we're with the struggle in Mississippi 1,000%. We're with the efforts to register our people in Mississippi to vote 1,000%. But we do not go along with anybody telling us to help nonviolence. We think if somebody is going to try, if the government says that Negroes have a right to vote, and then when Negroes go out to vote, some kind of Ku Klux Klan is going to put them in the river, and the government doesn't do anything about it, it's time for us to organize and band together and equip ourselves and qualify ourselves to protect ourselves. And once you can protect yourself, you don't have to worry about being hurt. That's it.
We declare our rank on this earth to be a man, to be a human being, to be respected as a human being, to be given the rights of a human being in this society, on this earth, in this day, which we intend to bring into existence by any means necessary.
Niggers are scared of revolution. But niggers shouldn't be scared of revolution.
All niggers.
Because revolution is nothing but change. And all niggers do is change. Niggers come in for work and change into pimping clothes. Hit the streets to make some quick change. Niggers change their hair from black to red to blonde. And old black hair and looks will change. Niggers kill other niggers just because one didn't receive the correct change. Niggers change from men to women, from women to men. Niggers change, change, change. You hear niggas say, things are changing, things are changing. Yeah, things are changing. Nigga things into black nigga things. Black nigga things that go through all kinds of changes. The change in the day that makes it ratty and made. Black power, and the change that comes over them at night that they sky and moan. Night skies, ooh, night skies. Niggas always going through bullshit change. But when it comes for real change, niggas are scared of revolution.
The injustice that has been inflicted upon Negroes in this country by Uncle Sam is criminal.
Niggas are actors. great white host. Niggas try to act like Malcolm. And when a white man doesn't react to them like he did Malcolm, niggas gonna act violently. Niggas act so cool. And split, causing white people to say, what makes you niggas act like that? Niggas act like you ain't never seen nobody act before. But when it comes to acting out revolution, niggas say, I can't dig in action. Niggas are scared of revolution.
I'm not an integrationist. Never could be. I couldn't integrate with my enemy. And I know who my enemy is.
Niggas are very untogether people. Niggas talk about getting high and riding around in L's. Niggas should get high and ride to hell. Niggas talk about pimping, pimping that, pimping what? Pimping yours, pimping mine. Just to be pimping is a hell of a line. Niggas are very untogether people. Niggas are players. Niggas are players, are players. Niggas play football, baseball, and basketball while the white man is coming off their ball. When a nigga's play ain't tight enough to play with some black guys, niggas play with white guys to see if they still have some play left. And when the white guys are play with, niggas play with themselves. Niggas tell you they're ready to be liberated, but when you say, let's go take our liberation, niggas reply, I was just playing. Niggas are playing with revolution and losing. Niggas are scared of revolution.
We don't want to have anything to do with any race of dogs, two-legged dogs, that will fix four-legged dogs on innocent, harmless women, children, and babies.
Niggas are lovers, are lovers, are lovers. Niggas love to hear Malcolm rap, but they didn't love Malcolm. Niggas love everything but themselves. But I'm a lover too. Yep, I'm a lover too. I love niggas, I love niggas, I love niggas. Because niggas are me, and I should only love that which is me. I love to see niggas go through changes, love to see niggas act, love to see niggas make them plays and shoot the shit. But there's one thing about niggas I do not love. Niggas are scared of revolution.
We declare our right on this earth to be a man, to be a human being, to be respected as a human being, to be given the rights of a human being in this society, on this earth, in this day, which we intend to bring into existence by any means necessary.
My earliest recollection is of being snatched awake in the middle of the night because our house was on fire. My mother was a West Indian from Grenada, and my father, a Millicent Baptist minister and follower of Marcus Garvey, preached race pride and separation from the white man, the lancing arm of the Ku Klux Klan, warning to stop preaching Garvey's message. But my father was not a frightened Negro, and he kept on. Next thing, he was found with his head bashed in, lying across the streetcar tracks. A trolley had nearly cut him in half.
Southern trees bear a strange fruit. Blood on the leaves and blood at the root. Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze. Strange fruit hanging from the poplar tree.
After my father's death, my mother tried to hold the family together. She couldn't find work because the Christian people of Lansing wouldn't hire the widow of a crazy nigger. She could stretch bread a dozen ways. Fried bread, stewed bread, and if she found raisins, bread pudding. When there was no bread, she fed us dandelions, fried grass. We were so hungry, we were dizzy.
No Negro leaders have fought for civil rights. They have begged the white man for civil rights. They have begged the white man for freedom. And anytime you beg another man to set you free, you will never be free. Freedom is something that you have to do for yourselves. And until the American Negro lets the white man know that we are really, really ready and willing to pay the price that is necessary for freedom, our people will always be walking around here second-class citizens, or what you call 20th century slaves.
What price are you talking about, sir?
The price of freedom is death.
We declare our right on this earth to be a man, to be a human being, to be respected as a human being, to be given the rights of a human being in this society, on this earth, in this day, which we intend to bring into existence by any means.
About the first third of the audience shouted, "Come out of my pocket, come out of my pocket." And I heard my husband say, "Everything is all right, everything is all right." And someone about third or so seated in about the third row stood up, and I heard shots. And I saw people crawling on the floor. And so I got down too. But then when I was looking out and I saw someone look in amazement to the front, I knew they had shot my husband.
What do you think of Malcolm X's death?
I know it was no accident.
Who do you believe is responsible for Malcolm X's
death?
The white
power structure in America is behind it. They're quick to capitalize on by saying that one of his own kind did it, but they put it up to be done.
What do you mean, the white power structure?
The white power structure of America. They know they had more to gain by getting Malcolm X out of the way than they had by letting him live. That's why.
But what is the white power structure?
Never mind. I just said the white power structure. You know the white race, don't you?
In the last year, like Roy Wilkins said, he changed. He wanted to get along with the white people. But you people didn't want to get along with us.
What does Malcolm X's death mean to you? What do you feel about it?
What do you feel about it?
What do you feel about it?
It's a blow to have a black people in the United States of America. Black!
It's what?
It's a blow, he said.
It's a blow.
Blow, he said.
Yes.
He says a blow to every black American, black people in the United States. That's what he was saying.
Why is it a blow to you?
Because he's a part of me. Because he looks like me. Stop and his skin is me. He's a black man, and I'm a black man. And he takes up a black man's position.
That's right.
He was a hero to me. He stood out among all black people.
That's
he
right.
He told the white man where was that.
But why, right. Why was he a hero?
He got respect. Why was he off it in Princeton and all these big white universities? Because they respected him too, the way I respected him.
That's
he meant
right.
Something to me. That's why I'm down here.
That's right.
Who they killed Malcolm X for? They hadn't like killing him.
He
that's
was right.
Men. He was for him.
Right.
And when you kill him, you're going to be more killing going on.
That's right.
And you're saying that you believe this was paid for by whites?
Yes, by white people. Because what would it benefit one of us to kill him? It wouldn't benefit us anything at all. Just a white power structure of this country. Anytime a black man in this country stands up for his constitutional rights, he dies. What did Malcolm X mean to you?
He meant a great deal to me and my people. I'm sorry that a good man is gone. At the first I hear of it, I couldn't have cried anymore, I don't believe, if I had lost my mother.
What did he mean to you? Can you tell me a bit more about it?
He meant deliverance for my people. And I hope we all walk in the same footsteps as Malcolm X was walking in.
at this final hour, in this quiet place, Harlem has come to bid farewell to one of its brightest hopes, extinguished now and gone from us forever. For Harlem is where he worked and where he struggled and fought, his home of homes, where his heart was and where his people are. And it is therefore most fitting that we meet once again in Harlem to share these last moments with him. For Harlem has ever been gracious to those who have loved her, have fought for her, and have defended her honor even to the death. It is not in the memory of man that this beleaguered, unfortunate, but nonetheless proud community has found a braver, more gallant young champion than this Afro-American who lies before us, unconquered still. Many will ask what Harlem finds to honor in this stormy, controversial, and bold young captain, and we will smile, and we will answer and say unto them, did you ever talk to Brother Malcolm? Did he ever touch you? Did you have him smile at you? Did you ever really listen to him? Did he ever do a mean thing? Was he ever himself associated with violence or any public disturbance? For if you did, you would know him. And if you knew him, you would know why we must honor him. Malcolm was our manhood, our living black manhood. That was his meaning to his people. And in honoring him, we honor the best in ourselves. And we will know him then for what he was and is, a prince, our black shining prince, who didn't hesitate to die because he loved us so.
To be respected as a human being, to be given the rights of a human being in this society, on this earth, in this day, which we intend to bring into existence by any means necessary.
We hate laziness. We hate drunkenness. We hate dope addiction. We hate nicotine. We hate all of the vices that the white man has taught us to partake in. And he accuses us of hating him. You don't know. Don't tell me Negro. That's nothing. What were you before the white man named you a Negro? And where were you? And what did you have? What was yours? What language did you speak then? What was your name? It couldn't have been Smith or Jones or Bunch or Powell. That wasn't your name. They don't have those kind of names where you and I came from. No, what was your name? And why don't you now know what your name was then? Where did it go? Where did you lose it? Who took it? And how did he take it? What tongue did you speak? How did the man take your tongue? Where is your history? How did the man wipe out your history? How did the man, what did the man do to make you as dumb as you are right now? If you can't do for yourself what the white man is doing for himself, don't say you're equal with the white man. If you can't set up a factory like he sets up a factory, don't talk that old equality talk.
This is American justice. This is American democracy. And those of you who are familiar with it know that in America, democracy is hypocrisy. Now, if I'm wrong, put me in jail. But if you can't prove that if democracy is not hypocrisy, then don't put your hands on me. Democracy is hypocrisy. If democracy means freedom, why aren't our people free? If democracy means justice, why don't we have justice? If democracy means equality, why don't we have equality?
So, brothers and sisters, since we can see that the Uncle Sam has failed us, and he has failed us, Eastland is part of Uncle Sam. Governor, Senator Russell, that's Uncle Sam. Goldwater, that's Uncle Sam. He's just as much Uncle Sam as Javits and Keating and the rest of them. All of them are part of the same system, and it is the system that is being used to deprive you and me of our rights. It's not a Southern senator. It's the system. The Southern senator is using an outdated system, an antiquated system, a very tricky and treacherous system to further the political oppression and the political exploitation of 22 million black people in this country. So what must we do? As long as we're running around here asking the white man for civil rights, we're at his mercy. As long as we're in Washington, D.C. asking him for civil rights, we're at his mercy. The entire civil rights program has to be expanded. Expanded from the level of civil rights to the level of human rights. When you take it from the level of civil rights and put it on the level of human rights, you internationalize the problem. And when you internationalize it, you open the gate for support from every nation on this planet who is for the human rights of mankind.